KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Just watching the videos that people have sent and pictures of what's left is like being gut punched.
The LA wildfires are picking up again, destroying entire communities as they burn. We'll hear about one gathering place that's no longer standing. For Saturday, January 11th, it's All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow. We'll have the latest on the wildfires, including a look at whether LA's fire department had the resources it needed. We'll also talk to outgoing Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg about why he thinks the Biden administration's big infrastructure push didn't seem to connect with voters.
Part of what we're doing is turning a very big ship in terms of the condition of American infrastructure, but that's going to take a lot of time.
And we'll hear about a new album of lullabies.
You're also getting flute and a little bit of harp. And, you know, I'm just kind of floating out in the waves.
First, this newscast.
Live from NPR News in New York City, I'm Dwahli Saikautau. On day five of raging wildfires in Southern California, more communities are under threat in the Los Angeles region. Elise Hugh reports.
Flames are stretching into the communities of Brentwood, West LA, and Mandeville Canyon in Los Angeles. Firefighters are conducting airdrops and digging lines on the ground in an effort to stop the flames from spreading. They are racing to contain the Palisades fire, which is already the biggest of the wildfires in the county, ahead of more wind events forecast for Monday. Los Angeles County Fire Chief Anthony Maroney gave an update.
LA County Fire will be prepared. These winds, combined with dry air and dry vegetation, will keep the fire threat in Los Angeles County high.
Dusk to dawn curfews are in effect for Palisades and Eaton fire evacuation zones. For NPR News, I'm Elise Hugh in Los Angeles.
Just over a week before President-elect Donald Trump takes office, groups of House Republicans are visiting Mar-a-Lago this weekend to meet with him. NPR's Amy Held reports the GOP is strategizing over how to push through its priorities.
As they prepare to take the trifecta of power in Washington, the GOP has a lot of issues they want to address, like immigration and border security, tax and spending cuts. And they want Trump to weigh in on how to prioritize and structure them. He met with Republican senators on Capitol Hill earlier this week and said he cares less about process, more about results.
We're looking at the one bill versus two bills, and whatever it is, doesn't matter. We're going to get the result.
Not if Democrats have their way. Republicans are considering tools to get around a filibuster, including the high-risk, high-reward reconciliation process that would allow for a simple majority to pass legislation. Amy Held, NPR News.
TikTok is awaiting a decision from the Supreme Court over a law that could ban the app by next Sunday. As NPR's Bobby Allen reports, lawyers for a video service say if it is shut down, lawmakers could go after other companies.
TikTok is asking the Supreme Court to pause or overturn a law prohibiting the app from operating in the U.S. unless it sheds its Chinese owner. TikTok's legal team told the court that upholding the ban will set a dangerous precedent. Lawyer Jeff Fisher, who represented creators on TikTok in the case, asked the justices why lawmakers did not appear worried about other Chinese apps in its crackdown.
Would a Congress really worried about these very dramatic risks leave out an e-commerce site like Temu that has 70 million Americans using it?
The Justice Department says China's potential influence over TikTok makes the app a risk to Americans' data and security. President-elect Donald Trump says once in office, he will find a way to save the app. Bobby Allen, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News. The nation's highest civilian honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom with Distinction, a rare award, is going to Pope Francis. President Biden made the announcement just hours ago after having called His Holiness to congratulate the 88-year-old. In a statement, Biden says the first pope from the Southern Hemisphere, Pope Francis, is unlike any who came before. Biden added, above all, he is the people's pope, a light of faith, hope and love that shines brightly across the world. Biden was scheduled to fly to the Vatican this weekend, but canceled due to the California wildfires. The Super Bowl in New Orleans is less than a month away, and public safety concerns have grown since the Bourbon Street attack on New Year's Day. As Joseph King of the Gulf States Newsroom reports, officials say state and local law enforcement are prepared.
At a press conference, New Orleans city officials reassured residents and visitors. New Orleans Mayor LaToya Cantrell said local agencies working alongside the Department of Homeland Security and other federal agencies have created a program for people and businesses involved with the Super Bowl to help identify any suspicious activity.
Our greatest asset, which we keep hearing over and over and which we know, are our people. And so if we can engage them in training, and it is specifically on security and terrorism training, awareness training, that we will be conducting.
Cantrell said there will be hundreds of local, state, and federal officers spread out across New Orleans to ensure public safety. For NPR News, I'm Joseph King.
And I'm Dwahli Saikautel, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Forecasters say gusty winds are picking up again in the L.A. area, which will mean wildfires are an ongoing threat in the region. A new round of evacuation orders were issued Friday night, meaning that there are now more than 160,000 people in the area under such orders. To date, around 12,000 structures have been destroyed in the wildfires, including homes, schools, and storefronts. The Real Inn was one of those places, located on the Pacific Coast Highway. It was a place you could find surfers, celebrities, and tourists alike waiting in line to eat after a day at the beach. And it's now been totally lost in the Palisades fire. NPR's Kira Joaquim caught up with the owners to learn how they're coping.
I'm Andy.
I'm Kira. Nice to meet you.
Pleasure.
I'm so sorry.
Wasn't what we ordered.
That's Andy Leonard. He and his wife, Teddy, have owned and operated The Real since 1988.
Okay, come on in and meet Teddy.
Thank you.
I met up with the Leonards at an Airbnb in Mar Vista, where they've evacuated as they wait to hear about the fate of their home, also in the path of the massive Palisades fire. But they say the loss of the restaurant is especially difficult to comprehend.
I went on our Instagram and started looking at people's pictures and stories they've been posting on our Instagram, and I started crying so much I had to stop because it's the community's loss.
We've given a lot of people a place to come that they sincerely believe is theirs.
After living in LA for decades, the Leonards have had close calls with fires before, but they say the recent spate of wildfires is like nothing they've ever seen.
It was so quick. It was like a car crash. I mean, usually when there's a fire, it's coming, it's coming, it's coming. What should we do? What should we do? It's coming. This one was like wham, and it was gone.
They both say they're not ready to see what may be left where the restaurant once stood.
Just watching the videos that people have sent and pictures of what's left is like being gut punched. You know, I think we're not quite ready. I'm not quite ready. And I don't really, are you? No, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. We're not. Well, we'll get there. We will get there. And, you know, and then maybe we'll meet the crew there, you know, so we can all have a moment where we can. But it's going to be a while.
Despite this personal turmoil, the couple say they're focused on helping their staff, some of whom have worked with them for decades.
Their kitchen chief called
this morning,
weeping, and said, "What do you guys need? Because you're hurt, and we're furiously peddling over here to help them." I mean, it's a family.
I mean, this is the kind of people that we had working for us. And that's why we're trying to get the word out there to raise funds for them. We'll do anything for them, and they will do anything for us.
Have done. They have done.
Yeah.
And while their world has been turned upside down, they say the support from the community is strengthening their resolve and has taught them a valuable lesson.
Honestly, as odd as this sounds, this time has blessed us in understanding the humanity, the beauty of the humanity. We have had more than our share of love and compassion. And I just would like everyone to remember that. And let's do it all the time. You know, let's take kindness out into the world. That feels right to me.
And though they know there's a long road ahead, the Leonards hope to rebuild what the community once had. Kira Joaquim, NPR News, Los Angeles.
And elsewhere in the program, we will hear how firefighters in LA are coping as they fight the largest wildfire in the city's history. Donald Trump is officially, formally a felon, and he's also, of course, about to become president of the United States. 10 days ahead of the inauguration, the one completed criminal case against Trump came to a formal end when New York Judge Juan Merchan sentenced Trump to an unconditional discharge 8 months after Trump was found guilty of falsifying business records. That sentence means no jail time or penalties, but the conviction stays on Trump's record. Trump spoke briefly, remotely, during the hearing.
I'm totally innocent. I did nothing wrong.
Given the conclusion for now of Trump's various criminal cases, it made sense to get the Trump's Trials podcast team back together and talk it through with NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Hey, Domenico.
Hey, Scott.
And University of Baltimore law professor Kim Whaley. Hey, Kim.
Hi there.
Kim, I want to start with you and just your basic reaction to the sentencing.
Well, I think the sentencing needs to be looked at in connection with the Supreme Court's 5-4 ruling on Thursday, basically refusing to stay the process. And they said in that ruling that the unconditional discharge, the trial court's stated intent to impose that unconditional discharge, is justification for not postponing it. So I really think when Judge Merchan said that it's the only option, it was the only option. Because if Trump had managed to delay the sentencing past inauguration, that immunity ruling would have kicked in and he would have said, I'm now a sitting president. You can't touch me, even for sentencing, and we'd be 4 years from now on the entire thing in the dustbin of history.
Is it fair to say the presidency is stronger and much more immune to the rule of law based on what happened over the last couple of years with these various cases and the Supreme Court rulings?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Supreme Court essentially amended the United States Constitution this summer in response to January 6, 2021, and Trump's actions on that day. The Constitution does not create immunity for presidents. It creates immunity for members of Congress. So the framers knew how to do that if they wanted to. And in Article 1, which outlines Congress's powers, it says that in a case of an impeachment of and presumably a president, there can be a criminal prosecution. So the court held the opposite. Essentially, there cannot be a criminal prosecution of official acts. But I don't think anyone would argue that you don't impeach for official acts. So I think the Supreme Court really did enhance the belt and suspenders of the power of the Oval Office, potentially to points that are quite dangerous moving forward. And that was in direct response to Donald Trump's alleged criminal activity.
I feel like this is a coda or a conclusion to sort of the Watergate era. You know, we didn't really get a lot of conclusion to the constitutional crises that were presented when Richard Nixon was in office, because Nixon wound up resigning. And having the Supreme Court weigh in on a lot of this, we've gotten more clarity on the fact that the highest court in the land wants to essentially give far more ability for a president to do kind of almost whatever they want as long as it's within their official capacity. They've essentially created, ironically, a kind of pseudo king.
I want to come back to what all of this means for the second Trump term that begins in less than 10 days in a moment. But Domenico, I just want to ask you about the politics of it at this moment now that the New York case has concluded and the federal cases are by and large gone right now and the Georgia case seems all but dead. You know, we've had several months since the election to think about what happened, to take a look at what the voters were telling us. What do you make of the argument that I feel like picked up steam after Trump won, that all of these cases put together, and really the New York case specifically, really helped Trump consolidate Republican support and maybe helped him return to the White House?
Trump obviously was able to consolidate power in a primary, certainly, and he was able to insulate himself to be able to say, these are all quote-unquote witch hunts, these are political prosecutions. And the New York case, and was the only one that we have a conclusion to, is pretty surprising, frankly. You know, I don't know that if none of these cases are brought that Donald Trump loses the election. I think that we have a very divided country politically, and Trump was certainly able to insulate himself, like I said, and able to get people on the right to say that they think that these things were all politically motivated. Anyway, I don't know that that's the reason that he won, but it certainly helped him through the primary.
Kim, I mean, the lawfare phrase that you had people in Trump's orbit talking about, like the idea that the justice system was being used as warfare politically against Trump, I do feel like has hardened, and I've heard more and more as Trump returns to power, regardless of whether or not you feel like that is a fair characterization, which I feel like you don't. The fact that that has really become a mainstream Republican view, what questions does that raise for how the Trump's Department of Justice starts acting again in fewer than 10 days?
Well, law at the end of the day is about incentives and disincentives. We have laws and constraints to disincentivize bad behavior, but those constraints don't mean anything if there's no consequences. So the Supreme Court, through this process, has removed any consequences for committing crimes using official power. That's the scary stuff, right? It's not the unofficial private power that is going to lead to some real abuses against individuals. It's the power of the Justice Department. It's the power of the FBI, the IRS, the CIA, the military. It's the stuff that Donald Trump will have at his fingertips that no one else on the planet has. That's the power that needs to be disincentivized to abuse. And that's gone. So we really are moving into a new era of American history and American law.
Last question to both of you. I was framing the sentencing in New York as the conclusion to all of these legal cases. I think that's true, but there might be one more coda in the next week. There's the possibility that a report from special counsel Jack Smith gets released to the public, at least a redacted version of it that's being fought over in the courts right now. Don't really know at this point if we're going to see it or not. But I'm gonna ask each of you, Kim, what's the biggest question? Is there anything you think in that report you want to know more about or you might learn from? Or do you think that will be generally the facts that we've been talking about for a year or so at this point?
Well, according to Donald Trump's lawyers, there is more information, which is why they worked so hard to keep it from the public. But I'm interested in the Mar-a-Lago case. I'm interested in understanding where the classified information went. There were empty folders that the FBI found. Who got it? Is there a threat to national security that was created in that scenario? I don't think those questions have been debated, let alone answered in a meaningful way.
You know, I'm going to be looking for politically what kind of declarations that Jack Smith makes in this that are easily digestible for people, what he believed Trump might have been guilty of, and what the evidence was that they were following.
Shortly after we taped this conversation, the Department of Justice announced that Special Counsel Jack Smith had resigned. That was University of Baltimore law professor Kim Whaley, as well as NPR's Domenico Montanaro. And you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Dwahli Saikautal in New York City with these headlines. Major wildfires continue to burn in Southern California. Meanwhile, residents in the L.A. area are creating pop-up aid centers to help thousands of displaced Angelenos. The online food company DoorDash temporarily suspended food delivery services in the Atlanta region because of severe winter weather. The company says operations resumed late this morning. Ukraine says it has captured North Korean prisoners of war in Russia's western Kursk region. President Volodymyr Zelensky says the two men are in custody and getting medical attention. I'm Dua Lisai-Kautau, NPR News in New York.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm, arm.com. From the SciSims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at SciSimsFoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. During his time as Secretary of Transportation, Pete Buttigieg had a lot on his plate. An airline industry scrambled by COVID, the environmental fallout of the East Palestine train wreck in Ohio, the fatal Key Bridge collapse in Baltimore, and the distribution of billions of dollars in infrastructure spending, among many other things. Now, with barely a week until President-elect Donald Trump's inauguration, Buttigieg, along with the Biden administration's other cabinet members, will be packing up his office and preparing to return to civilian life. Secretary Pete Buttigieg, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
I want to start by talking about the thing that probably got the most attention throughout the course of the administration. That was all the infrastructure spending, because I think that's a good example of something that, you know, seems to do all of the things that a lot of people think that the voters want from government, investing in communities, fixing problems, coming together to fix those problems, spending at historic levels. You and others in the administration spent years getting the message out there, putting these projects into place. I know how many airports you visited to tout these accomplishments. And yet a lot of different metrics, including the election results, suggest that maybe voters didn't quite appreciate that. It didn't seem to land. It didn't seem to be a consensus of, wow, the Biden administration did this for me. I'm wondering how you make sense of all of that.
Well, a lot of the things that we work on are worth doing, whether they're getting you a lot of political credit or not. We do safety work to save people from losing their lives on our roadways or in the aviation system. We don't expect people to cheer for us on doing that. We just do it because it's the right thing to do. And our infrastructure is something that should just work. That said, I do think that as more and more of these projects go to completion, we're going to see more and more of an appreciation for what this infrastructure era has done to make people better off. We're already seeing levels of employment in construction, building trades, manufacturing that we haven't seen in my lifetime. Think about the Affordable Care Act. It took years before people fully appreciated them. And the very nature of infrastructure work is it takes some time. That said, I'm going to keep telling the story and waving the flag because it is extraordinary what we did and what will continue to happen in this country. It didn't happen on its own. It was a bipartisan achievement at a time when anything bipartisan is pretty rare in this town. And I think we're going to be benefiting from it for the rest of our lives.
That being said, this idea that Americans wanted to see their government working for them more was such a concrete thesis of the Biden administration. It's something that you campaigned and wrote about before you joined this administration. Given where we are at this point in time, the transition of power that's happening, has that made you rethink anything, whether it was the way that this was approached or the way that it was communicated?
We always knew that part of what we're doing is turning a very big ship in terms of the condition of American infrastructure and the condition of a lot of things that Americans count on government to do. But that's going to take a lot of time, and that the best thing that could come of that is a higher baseline level of public trust in what government can do for them.
Do you think you achieved that?
Well, I think we set things on a different trajectory, but we're also operating in a different information environment. We're now living in a time where some dude on the internet has as much authority as somebody holding themselves to the highest journalistic standards of fact-checking and research. And that is something that I think can swamp a lot of our more traditional calculations about what makes for good policy and good politics.
you, up until this point, are the most high-profile millennial to hold national office. I guess Vice President-elect Vance will join that club in a matter of weeks. But as we talk about this, I'm wondering, you came of age with the internet. Do you think it's done more harm or good for government, for public policy at this point in time?
I think at best it has cut both ways. You know, one thing that I think it has made possible is it's empowered everybody to be a reporter. And there are things that we find out about, including things that have happened in our communities or on our streets that no one would have known about if it weren't possible to record and publicize that through the internet. On the other hand, what we found is that everybody is a reporter, but nobody's an editor. And the idea that you do, in fact, have a responsibility to separate fact from fiction, to make judgments about what deserves real scrutiny or real attention, that's something that has clearly weakened in our society as a result of some of these technologies. Also, for my entire lifetime, you could use a photograph usually to settle a question about whether something was true or false. That's less and less true. And adapting to things like that is really going to test our capacity as a society, as a species.
I want to talk about, for a moment, social justice and transportation. You at times talked about Robert Moses and got the attention of nerds who love The Power Broker. But, you know, to get to these broader examples of the way that infrastructure and transportation projects were often built in a way that furthered injustice instead of helping to fix it, you had talked early on about wanting to take that head on. And are there areas where you feel like you accomplished that goal, whether it was a neighborhood where it was a particular road?
Yeah, I mean, we were able through so many of our projects to empower the very kinds of people and homes and families and neighborhoods that used to get rolled over by transportation projects in the past. And that's really twofold, both making neighborhoods better off with transit access to places that didn't have it in the past or roads that are built with their neighborhood in mind, but also the jobs we created. I mean, the number of people getting good paying jobs in the building trades who are actually literally making these things happen and happen in the neighborhoods where they grew up in is extraordinary, and I believe it's unprecedented. So we've really been able to make a big difference there. Still a long way to go. You know, it took decades to get the way we are, everything good and everything that needs to change. And it's going to take a while to get to a new reality, but we're well underway in what I like to call this infrastructure decade.
When you made those comments, there was this parallel reaction of excitement from people who love 1,000-page books and criticism in some of the right-wing press that this was yet another example of identity politics, social justice type governing. And I'm asking that because in the months since the election, there has been all of this back and forth about, did Democrats kind of veer too far in that lane? Did that hurt them politically? I'm wondering what you make about that general conversation and if you have any big takeaways on the policies of the last 5 or 6 years and how people are interpreting them.
You know, I think it was a reminder of how some voices in the media can get people whipped up over anything when we're talking about measures that don't make anyone worse off and make a lot of people better off. I will never be able to relate to the idea that it's wrong to confront segregation that neighborhoods still have to live with because of some physical design decision that was made in the 50s or 60s. When we see that, we should put it right. And that's what we set out to do.
Do you think there's something to the idea that your party needs to talk about these things in a different way to bring more people along?
I think any way you come at it, the most important thing is the actions, not the words. I think that there has been a lot of hyperventilating about vocabulary. I think that, you know, this is something that you see in different flavors from all sides of the aisle. You know, my side of the aisle gets lost in jargon sometimes. And there's some really troubling things that you see in terms of vocabulary of what comes from the other side of the aisle, too. But look, the bottom line is we need to do the thing and then figure out how to talk about what we're doing. And the thing that we're doing is fixing roads and bridges across the country.
You're going to be a private citizen. You, along with many other Democrats, really raised deep, deep concerns about what a second Trump administration would mean on the rule of law, on democracy, on many other fronts. How are you going to be approaching that, whatever you do next? How are you going to be responding? Do you have any thought about what you will charge yourself with doing when you're out of office?
What I know is that most Americans believe in some basic values and some very important norms that hold our country together. frankly, no matter how you voted, a strong majority of Americans believe in making sure that, that our country is a freedom-loving place, that people have rights, and that we solve big problems together. And that's something that I'm going to continue to care about and work on. I'll be doing it as a citizen rather than as a policymaker, at least for the foreseeable future. And I'm going to do everything I can to work on the things I care about and the things that are going to matter to our family in Michigan and to so many people who I've gotten to know along the way in this work.
Secretary Pete Buttigieg, thanks so much.
Thank you. Good speaking with you.
You can hear more of our conversation with Secretary Buttigieg tomorrow on All Things Considered. If you're a football fan, fall and winter can often feel like a soap opera. There's heartbreak, there's rivalry, revenge, falls from grace, and of course, every so often, the brightest, most wonderful, most fleeting joy that you can imagine.
We've made it back to the playoffs! Yes!
Tom Grassi has been making NFL content on YouTube for almost a decade, and last season, he started parodying every weekly twist and turn in his If the NFL Was Scripted series, where he plays the NFL scriptwriter, plus the ref, plus every NFL team as himself. Well, as the NFL playoffs get underway with Wild Card Weekend, we decided to ask Tom how he thinks it will go down if he were truly the NFL scriptwriter. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Scott.
Before we get into the playoffs and how you would script it, I do want to just start with the series. Where did you first get this idea?
So I came up with this week two of the 2023 and 2024 NFL season. And it was after Aaron Rodgers went down, and that was like a Monday night, and the whole air got sucked out of MetLife Stadium.
Oh, yeah.
But around that time, like, there was like the jokes about it being scripted. So I put out like a 7-8 minute video, and it blew up. I was like, you know what? I really think that I could take what's going on within the league and say, hey, I can do kind of this recap while also making it entertaining and funny and kind of putting my own little spin on it.
Yeah. All right. So let's put that persona to work. What is the hottest plot line for you going into the first round?
Listen, you know, when it comes to the Green Bay Packers, of course, I will always, always be optimistic in thinking that they can beat the Philadelphia Eagles. But I think the bigger plot line is going to be what happens with the Chiefs, because the Chiefs, we all know, is the NFL scriptwriter's favorite.
Right.
And so it's just going to be a matter of, can the Chiefs finally, finally lose? And if they do lose, what is the reason why? Because the scriptwriter's got to have a pretty good reason for the Kansas City not to go all the way. But if the Chiefs were to lose in the Super Bowl, I think just the sigh of relief that would come from a good chunk of the nation watching of, oh, we don't have to watch the same team win it three times in a row would be pretty spectacular.
I trust that you can put your Packers fandom aside as we talk about another NFC North
team. Of course.
Lions, right? Historically bad, like decades-long
yes.
joke of the NFL. They've had this recent resurgence. This year, it seems to all be coming together. In your non-biased, again, opinion, what do you think the perfect ending is for a team like the Lions?
I mean, their perfect ending is winning the Super Bowl. And I've talked to a lot of Lions fans. I've talked to Lions fans where they didn't win a single game in a calendar year, which is very bad. Then they went through some really bad coaches. And ultimately, they got Dan Campbell, and they've been drafting well. They won two playoff games last year. So this year, the expectations were, okay, we won our playoff game. We won our division. Now we want to be contending for a Super Bowl. And things were looking really good. And then everybody got injured, especially on the defensive side of the ball. Now, for them to go out and beat the Vikings on Sunday Night Football, the last regular season game, their defense looked great. They got some guys back from injury. And now they're supposed to get even more folks back from injury. For their fan base, like it's not confusion, but it's kind of, I don't know what to do with my hands because we have not been in this situation before.
I want to ask you about one more big storyline for the playoffs. And that's a storyline that people always love. And that's a rookie quarterback, right?
Mm.
You've got Bo Nix and the Broncos. You've got Jaden Daniels and the Commanders, both in the playoffs. Both of these teams have had these real Cinderella story years. What do you think should happen?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, for the Broncos, it's just super impressive because they were being considered as one of the worst teams heading into this year. They had a ton of dead cap because they just got rid of Russell Wilson, their former quarterback that they made a big trade for. And to come in with a rookie quarterback and a great defense and to make it to the seventh seed, they arguably have the toughest road ahead because they're going up against the Bills, who are a very good football team. They're going to have to beat their former Super Bowl champion, former player in Von Miller, who is now with the Bills. So that's a fantastic storyline there. And then for Jaden Daniels, they're going up against Baker Mayfield, that matchup in of itself, the Commanders versus the Buccaneers, is, hey, you have this rookie quarterback in Jaden Daniels, who is likely going to win Offensive Rookie of the Year. He's been having a great year, versus a quarterback that a lot of people forgot about or kind of wrote off. That's always the entertaining storylines, because that's the stuff that goes beyond football, right? Because it's like, oh, you would get invested in the people and the individuals and the players and their story and their journey. And that's what makes this sport, you know, one of the best ones in the world.
That is Tom Grossi, creator of If the NFL Was Scripted and so much other NFL content over at YouTube. Thank you so much for joining us, and enjoy the playoffs.
Scott, really appreciate you. Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The biggest of several wildfires still burning out of control in Los Angeles grew by more than 1,000 acres overnight. More than 300,000 people are now under evacuation orders or in evacuation warning areas. As the firefight continues, questions are beginning to mount about whether LA was adequately prepared. NPR's Kirk Siegler has the latest.
Clayton Colbert, a Malibu resident of 45 years, stayed behind when the Palisades fire exploded, figuring he could pump water from the ocean to douse hot spots igniting from embers.
That's our fire hoses there. We saw this coming.
Colbert, exhausted, with black rings of ash under his eyes, is relieved his home between Pacific Coast Highway and the beach is still standing. As we speak, his neighbor's home is engulfed in flames. Two firefighters and an engine can't save it.
I've been doing this for 48 hours or more. There was a period here for 24 hours where there wasn't a fire truck or firefighter or anybody, actually.
You hear this a lot in the fire zones where even hydrants have gone dry. But Colbert isn't sure anything would have mattered. It was so dangerous in the L.A. basin with hurricane-force Santa Ana winds.
Listen, if you look and see what happened in the Palisades and everywhere else, there could be 6,000 firefighters and it wouldn't be enough.
Still, the political finger-pointing has begun over whether more could have been done sooner. Asked about recent budget cuts, L.A. Fire Chief Kristen Crowley told CBS News that did hamper some training and disaster preparedness.
We did exactly what we could with what we had.
Would more resources have helped?
If I had 1,000 engines to throw at this fire, I honestly don't think 1,000 engines at that very moment could have tapped this fire down.
Only recently have winds calmed enough for water scooping planes to fly over the fires, at least for now. It's an extraordinary view from this beach. Huge planes flying in pairs skim the Pacific Ocean, then fly directly over the Santa Monica Mountains. L.A. is a city built out into flammable wildlands from its famous coast to rugged, densely populated canyons with one-way-in, one-way-out roads to mountains as high as 10,000 feet. The LAFD has long been a leader in knocking down urban wildfires. Fire agencies from around the West come here to train. But this past week has tested the best, says UCLA researcher Edith DeGuzman.
You have embers flying miles apart. Fire ignition is extremely difficult to predict or control, and it's happening simultaneously in so many places.
DeGuzman says climate change is accelerating the extremes. There were two extraordinarily wet years building up vegetation, and this year, so far, no rainy season. Experts say even the most prepared fire agencies in the world can't do much when infernos like these ignite. DeGuzman says further complicating things are all the wooden homes here, relics of early 20th century earthquake construction.
We have infrastructure and development that is a legacy of a period when we had less extreme conditions climate-wise. And we also have, you know, fewer people.
That's clear even along the posh coastline, where mansions mingle with older, funkier, modest homes, like in Clayton Colbert's neighborhood, which is an eerie shell of its former self.
There was a three-story wood structure house right there between there, and that went up like a Roman candle.
Everything is gone, he says. Kirk Siegler, NPR News, Los Angeles.
This is NPR News.
In Drag, the musical, every character, male, female, gay, straight, young, and old, discovers the magic of drag.
that power of transformation and like becoming something that you imagine you can be, I feel like that can speak to literally anybody.
We speak with co-star and co-writer Justin Honnard, who's also the drag superstar Alaska, Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Dwahli Saikautau in New York City with these headlines. California firefighters are bracing for more strong winds as they try to contain blazes that have so far killed 11 people and scorched 12,000 structures. Meanwhile, across the South, snow, freezing rain, and ice threaten the region, even forcing the National Basketball Association to postpone the Atlantic Hawks home game against the Houston Rockets. Over in the Mideast, a possible sign of progress in ceasefire negotiations as the director of Israel's Mossad Foreign Intelligence Agency, David Barnier, could soon head to Qatar for talks on the war in Gaza. I'm Dwahli Saikautau, NPR News in New York.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Forester with an updated exterior design and an 11.6-inch Starlink multimedia interface. Learn more at Subaru.com. From the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. And from ECMC Foundation, at ecmcfoundation.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. I will be honest, sometimes I daydream about a different job, wondering what life would be like if I hadn't become a journalist and instead taught high school English or was a lawyer or, you know, professional baseball player. Well, Vermont Public producer Burgess Brown daydreams about that too.
I'm very happy to be a journalist, but I have to tell you that I sometimes think about another path, a fantasy career of sorts.
His alternative life career path?
It's my country mailman dream. In it, I drive a beat-up Forester full of mail in a small town somewhere. I know my neighbors, I know their dogs, I watch their kids grow up. How romantic.
A mailman. The next best thing to being a mailman, in Burgess's case, was reporting on them. Brave Little State is a podcast that answers listener questions about Vermont. In a recent episode, he took on a question about the state of the United States Postal Service and found it is not quite as romantic as he imagined.
It's a frigid day in January 2024, and people in Montpelier are pissed.
182 days! That's how long Montpelier has been without a post office.
A couple hundred concerned Montpelierites are gathered in front of the federal building downtown. It used to house the city's post office until it flooded in the summer of 2023. 6 months later, it's still sitting there, empty.
In the days after the July flood, the residents and friends of Montpelier showed up.
Ben Doyle is standing at a microphone on the slushy sidewalk, flanked by members of Vermont's congressional delegation. Ben chairs the Montpelier Commission for Recovery and Resilience, created to respond to the devastating July flood.
Teenagers mucked out basements. Neighbors checked on neighbors. The delegation showed up. The governor showed up. Philanthropy showed up. You showed up. But 182 days later, you know who hasn't shown up? United States Postal Service leadership.
Those 182 days were a confusing and often frustrating time for Montpelier residents. For a while, the makeshift postal presence in town consisted of two or three delivery trucks that served as ad hoc PO boxes, surrounded by stacks of plastic crates overflowing with mail and packages. They didn't sell stamps and only accepted prepaid mail, so residents had to drive to neighboring towns for that. There was no electricity and no AC in the summer, and then, as temperatures dropped, no heat. At one point, postal workers were burning open fires in a metal tub to keep warm while they handed out mail. Concerned citizens and the congressional delegation wrote letters to management demanding that Postmaster General DeJoy provide a timeline for a new permanent post office location. But nothing. Residents' patience was wearing thin, like local business owner Kate Welly McCabe.
We are not asking for a miracle here. What we're asking for is for our federal government to do the most basic of things, and that is to give us a working post office right here in town.
Johanna Nichols said that the trek to neighboring Barrie to use postal services there was hurting Montpelier seniors.
Have you tried the entrance to the Barrie post office? It's pretty tricky.
The pressure campaign continued through the winter. And in April of last year, the Postal Service announced that they'd signed a lease on a downtown property. They promised a fully functional post office before the start of the summer. But summer came, and the summer went, and then the autumn, and still no post office. In October, the American Postal Workers Union rallied on the Statehouse lawn, and Ben Doyle showed up with some updated figures.
449 days. We're waiting, and we're not going to take it any longer.
One of the most consistent criticisms I heard during this time was that Montpelier residents didn't really know where to go to get their mail or what the plan was for the future. They were frustrated by the lack of communication from Postal Service management.
Like, yeah, we can write them or we can call them, and they're not going to get back to us, or they don't really care what we think, or we're howling to the wind.
Ben, townspeople, our congressional delegation spent 15 months howling into the wind. And then, in the midst of my reporting for this story, 460 days after the flood and with little fanfare, it finally happened.
You've got the scissors. As the postmaster, you can be cutting the ribbon.
It's October 12th, 2024 in downtown Montpelier, and there's a grand opening happening.
First and foremost, welcome everyone to the Montpelier Post Office. This is certainly an exciting day in Montpelier Post Office history, and we're so very thankful to so many of you who have worked tirelessly to get this office back open.
Michael Hakey, a postal operations manager, is presiding over this celebration. Press people appear to outnumber townspeople, and there are only four press people.
We'll now cut the ribbon, which will signify the official grand opening of the Montpelier Post Office. We have Postmaster Doug Powell will cut the ribbon.
We're officially open.
Excellent. Congratulations. Perfect. Thank you.
Did you catch that? Congratulations, or thank you. That sounds about right. Congratulations, you got your post office back, or thank you for your patience. It's hard to know what to make of this day when it took so long to arrive. And then when it finally did, it kind of arrived with a bit of a whimper. After the ribbon cutting, I watched locals peer into the windows and then kind of timidly walk in to see if, this time, their post office really was open. And whatever their gripes with the Postal Service, they were glad to see a familiar face behind the counter.
It was great to see you, Ned. All right, I'll see you soon.
Wendy Gillander, a post office clerk in Montpelier.
So it's been great.
Yeah.
I'm really happy to be back and seeing our regular customers again on a more regular basis, yeah. I guess I would say.
Wendy spent the last 460 days in snow, in rain, and heat, making sure that Montpelier residents got their mail. Wendy knows her neighbors, and she knows their kids, and she knows their dogs, and they all know her, too.
Yay! Yay, great. Thank you so
much. I'm glad you have a home.
That was Burgess Brown on Vermont Public's Brave Little State podcast. There is a lot of serious and at times pretty scary news out there in the world right now. And in moments like this, it is good to turn to our favorite music to calm our nerves. But one rock band, Starflyer 59 from Riverside, California, has taken things one step further. They reimagined 3 decades worth of their own songs as lullabies. I feel ready to enjoy the warm embrace of sleep already, but I will wake myself up, continue recording this segment, and talk about these lullabies and the cult band behind them with NPR music producer Lars Gotrich. Hey, Lars.
Hey, Scott. I'm ready to enter the dream state with one of my favorite bands of all time.
Let's do it. So Starflyer 59 has been around for more than 30 years. I imagine this is a new name for a lot of listeners. Mm-hmm. Give us a sense of who they are.
Starflyer 59 has basically been one person for the last 3 decades, okay. Jason Martin. And he's the son of a trucker. When he was a teenager in Southern California, he fell in love with The Cure and with The Smiths. And initially, when he started Starflyer, the idea was to kind of marry dreamy melodies with heavy guitar riffs, like Black Sabbath and Deep Purple and stuff like that. And a great example of the kind of music that they were making at that time in 1994, 1995, is this song called Hazelwood.
So we got that.
Yeah.
And then there's the version on the new album, Déjame Dormir, which means Let Me Sleep. So to put it mildly, that is wildly different. What inspired them to take songs like that and go sleepy time with them?
I've interviewed Jason Martin a handful of times over the years, and he once told me, I like listening to something that I don't do, and then incorporating that a little bit into what I do. So when he was making those early shoegaze records, he would throw on a surf rock lick or a doo-wop melody, and that kind of makes everything a little bit off, but very distinct. It's one of the main reasons I've loved his music for so long. So when Starflyer 59, already one of the dreamiest bands to take rock and roll sideways, announced that they would make this album of lullabies, I was ready. So I want to share another song. This one's called All My Friends Who Play Guitar.
It's really relaxing.
Yeah. So that is his signature guitar tone. He loves surf rock music. He always has. So you hear a little bit of that, but you're also getting flute and a little bit of harp. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm just kind of floating out in the waves. And I don't know, I kind of need that gentleness right now.
That makes sense. You know, when I had kids, I was turned on to this whole genre of music out there, of taking pop hits, everything from Beyonce to Black Sabbath, and lullabyizing them.
Yes.
You know, and I feel like a lot of new parents like get into that. What makes this album different from the stuff that's out there already?
So one, those lullaby versions, the ones that you're talking about, weren't made by the original artist. They're usually made by studio musicians. Two, they were made for parents of newborns and infants in sort of a cheeky way.
Yeah.
Like, it was like you're getting away with playing Snoop Dogg for an 8-week-old, mm-hmm. you know, basically.
Yeah.
But three, Jason Martin has kind of been in a reflective mode lately. He put out this great record last year that was one of my favorites of 2024 called Lust for Gold. And so he was kind of looking back on his shoegaze years, and he decided to make a record in that realm, but also took it as an opportunity to kind of wax nostalgic on old friends. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit of a bummer. So he's been thinking about all of that. And so it made sense to me that he took all these songs from across from his catalog and decided to make these kind of even dreamier versions. In fact, one of those songs from Lust for Gold that I love is called YZ80. And it's about an old motorcycle, and it's about old friends. And if you read the lyrics, they're sad.
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of the mode there. But this version, you don't need to know that it's sad. You just need to know that you can drift off to blissful sleep. You know, it's for everybody.
You know, the next time I'm overly tense, which happens quite a lot.
Yeah.
I will put this new album on in the background, see how it goes. That is NPR music producer Lars Gotrich talking about the new album from Starflyer 59 called Déjame Dormir, or Let Me Sleep. Thanks a lot, Lars.
Thank you.
And another music news, Sam Moore, half of the iconic 1960s soul duo Sam and Dave, has died. Moore was best known for singing enduring soul hits like Soul Man, Hold On, I'm Coming, and more. He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with his counterpart, Dave Prater, in 1992. Their music influenced artists like Michael Jackson, Al Green, and Bruce Springsteen, among others. But before he rose to soul music stardom, Moore got a start singing as a young kid at church. Here's Moore in a 2006 interview with Fresh Air's Terry Gross.
I remember the first time I was given a solo to sing with the adult choir. I forgot the words.
Oh, no.
I did. I mean, it was a most embarrassing situation because here's this little guy standing up before the big choir, and I have this solo to sing, and they're going to be singing behind me, and I forgot the words.
Moore met Dave Prater in 1961 in Miami. The two quickly became a popular local duo, transforming the call and response tradition of gospel music into an energetic stage act. The two were also a volatile duo. Moore says they argued a lot and that their drug use made the problems worse. The group faded from popularity after the 1960s. They broke up in 1970. Soul Man hit the charts again when Saturday Night Live stars John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd covered it as the Blues Brothers. Moore had mixed feelings about the hit becoming associated with that act. He recalls younger audiences thinking it was the Blues Brothers original. Moore kept recording and singing long after, releasing his final album, Overnight Sensational, in 2006. Moore was 89 years old.
I can't stand the rain against my window. Bring back sweet memories. I can't stand the rain against my window, because she's not here with me.
When we were together, everything was so good.
For Saturday, that's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. We will be back tomorrow and hope you'll join us. Until then, stay safe. Have a great night.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
You people can-
can watch while I'm scrubbing these floors, and I'm scrubbing the floors while you're gawking. Maybe once you tip me and it makes you feel swell in this crummy southern town, in this crummy old hotel, but you'll never guess to who you're talking. No, you could never guess to who you're talking. Then one night there's a scream in the night, and you wonder who could that have been. And you see me kind of grinning while I'm scrubbing. And you say, what she got to grin? I'll tell you, there's a ship, the Black Freight.